It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. This hour, our digital lives. Take a minute to think about how much time you spend online. If you're like most of us, you check your email or log into social media pretty much first thing in the morning. And we both love and hate that connection, right? And I can catch up with an old friend on Facebook or see what's happening halfway around the world in real time through Twitter. And that's great. But I also worry about what all that time online is doing to my attention span and my real human relationships. So we'll talk about that in a bit. But first, maybe there's something even more important to worry about. In her new book, The People's Platform, filmmaker Astra Taylor argues that our digital life is undemocratic, that we've handed our political and economic power over to giant tech corporations who make money off of our posts and tweets. In other words, there's a reason we just can't get enough of the internet.
I think we need to talk about the way that these devices and these platforms and these websites are actually addictive by design. Every aspect of a website like Facebook is tested to see what gets us to engage the most. So everything from the color schemes to where buttons are placed, and they need to maximize our engagement, to maximize our clicks, because they get data from that. And that's actually the business model of these sites. They're advertising financed. And so they need us to engage and to give more information and to like as many things as possible, because that's where the profit comes from. So I think it's important to shift that, to go, this is not just about us being unable to control our impulses. It's more like the way sugary cereals are stocked on the bottom row at the grocery store so that, you know, kids go crazy and can't help but ask their parents for them.
Well, this sounds like media criticism 101 in the sense that, remember the discussions of subliminal advertising back in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, there is something surprisingly retrograde. I've been saying that we've almost arrived in a retrograde future, because there was this idea that the internet would break us out of all of these old systems and out of the old media model, you know, out of the old broadcasting model where a small number of people got to tell us what to watch because they programmed the television or the radio. But I that's why I find it so interesting that for all of this technological innovation, we're still actually completely advertiser dependent. I mean, with the exception of Wikipedia, we do not spend any time on non-commercial spaces on the web. Hmm. No, you know, there's no significant non-commercial website online. So we're in this strange moment where you see a resurgence of things like native advertising, which is essentially brand-sponsored content or news, you know. This conjures up the old days of soap operas that sold soap, or the Camel News Caravan, which was the cigarette-sponsored news show. So again, the retrograde future, we've kind of come forward technologically, but economically, we're still in the old days.
Well, that kind of sheds new light on why everybody likes Mad Men so much.
Yeah, I mean, because it's still relevant. That's still, in many ways, the system that we're in. And, you know, the advertising industry has not been disrupted, to use the kind of Silicon Valley jargon, at all. There's more and more money going into that arena, and more of it's flowing online in ways that I think are pretty troubling if you care about democracy. And that really is media criticism 101. And I think there was this idea that the internet almost made that kind of media criticism irrelevant. Because, again, we would all be able to choose and be in charge of ourselves in this digital sphere. And I think what we need to actually think about how that school of thought applies in a digital age.
I guess in some ways, maybe we sort of feel like the ads are just the price we have to pay for getting this huge thing called the internet. I mean, for example, yeah, I liked Facebook a lot better before all the ads. But, you know, mostly I see them as an annoyance and I scroll past and I just don't look at them. And I do get to connect with my friends for free. Maybe the ads are just the price I have to pay.
Right. I think there needs to be a more critical interrogation of the idea that we get these services for free. Because, you know, advertising isn't free. We are paying with our data, which is what these marketers then collect and analyze and use to reach us with their targeted pitches. And I think there are actually social costs that go far beyond just the kind of annoyance element of, you know, sort of these things in the side of my browser that I don't want to look at. And those elements are really important, because the way that advertising used to work, it was much more straightforward, right? Something would come on the TV or the radio that interrupted the regularly scheduled programming and you could turn it off. But what happens is you can never turn off these systems of tracking online. I mean, and this leads not just to, again, the annoying ads, but to things like price discrimination. Because what one person sees on the web isn't what another person sees online. So I might get an ad that says, you know, Astra Taylor, enroll at this fancy college next year. But somebody else might get an ad that says, hey, enroll at this predatory for-profit college. You know, there's real concerns about redlining, about people being offered different interest rates or different prices on goods that will kind of reinforce old social inequities. So again, it's not as simple as just seeing ads. There's also this question like, well, what kind of culture do advertisers want to support? Because you might say, okay, it seems like a fair trade-off now. I liked Facebook better before. But the question is, what direction is it heading in? And so we're seeing signs of that with things like the pay to promote. You know, it's getting harder and harder for groups to reach their bases, the people that they've managed to connect with. You know, a community group might have 10,000 likes or something like that, but now it's only reaching a fraction of them when it sends out a message.
And on the other hand, it's interesting that a lot of us regard the internet and digital technology as this great democratizing force, you know, that gives everybody a platform to be heard regardless of status. I mean, think about the Arab Spring or the recent democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong.
That was something that really motivated me to take a more critical look, because I've got various sort of sidelines. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I work as a journalist, but I also do a lot of organizing and activism. And so this issue of democracy really matters to me and people having a voice. And I was concerned about the fact that we are handing over so much power to these corporate platforms, because the internet, again, because there are very few non-commercial spaces online, we confuse ourselves when we talk about it as a sort of public square. You know, when I go out and I protest in the streets, I have certain rights, rights that cannot be impinged upon by the government. I have the right to assembly and free speech and stuff like that. And when you go onto these social media sites, you are agreeing to a terms of service and you're handing away a lot of those rights. So if those are kind of our agoras in the digital age, you know, there are real concerns in terms of maintaining our freedom to protest and our freedom to challenge people in power.
Sure, but can't you do the same thing online? You can create a blog and put it up there, make a video and put it on YouTube.
Yeah, the thing is that you can, but those sites ultimately can take anything you put up there down. And there have been some examples of Middle East protesters putting up pictures of the documented violence onto a site like Flickr, wanting to spread the word and say, this is happening to us. And then Flickr took all of the photos down and said, well, you know, we don't allow pictures of violence on our site. And they were saying, well, these are political photographs documenting something really important. So it's just that sense that these spaces are not safe. We can't count on them in the same way because, again, they're private. I mean, I can't go and lead a protest in a shopping mall, right? Because that's not public space. That's private property. And these platforms are more like private property. They're more like shopping malls than they are like the things we like to compare them to. We like to say Google's a library, or we like to say Twitter's a town square. But there are major differences there. I feel like our analogies kind of confuse us. I feel like the question to me at a philosophical level is like, well, what would a real public square look like in the digital world? Like we don't have any real examples of that. And I think it would be kind of neat to get together and try to make those.
It's really interesting hearing you say that because, you know, these same critiques were made of commercial television back in the dark ages. And it's kind of funny to think it was only, what, a few decades ago that NPR was created. Are you saying we need a public digital sphere? And then what would that look like?
Right. I think we do need that. It's really interesting to go back to the history books and read about the evolution of public or non-commercial media in the United States. And we were pretty late on the bandwagon, right? Mm-hmm. Something like public broadcasting only emerged in the 60s. But people were sounding the alarm about it and trying to build alternatives going way back to the early days. So I feel like we could hypothetically be heading towards that kind of tipping point in the digital space where you just go, I'm tired of all my news being actually like branded content.
So you're really talking about maybe we're heading toward a new era of regulation on the internet and simply applying some of the same kinds of regulations the FCC applied to radio and television stations maybe need to be kind of readapted for the digital age. So that's kind of at this larger political level. What about, are there things that individual users could do?
Yeah, there's, you know, we have to not be as susceptible to convenience as the ultimate virtue. And it's very hard as an internet user. I think that if we could resist convenience, the temptation of convenience, and do things that are a bit more difficult in the digital space, that could have a big impact. So what do I mean? I mean things as simple as not always buying everything from Amazon, right? You can buy books from your local bookstore, even if you're not physically near them, by going to that store's website. Since writing my book, I've started to use non-Google email services. There are things like RiseUp.net, which is a nonprofit privacy-respecting email service, or Fastmail, where you pay, you know, a small sum in the scheme of things for email, but in return, you're not paying with your personal data and you're not being subjected to advertising. So I think there are lots of little things that we can do. But in the book, I try to balance these individual options with an awareness that we do need to think about bigger collective political fixes, and that we shouldn't be so afraid of the word regulation. I mean, you know, doing nothing means that we are basically giving more and more power to the marketing, advertising and marketing industry, and to this handful of big corporate players.
Astra Taylor is a filmmaker and author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. There's a scenario that used to be a staple in comedy or humor. The whole family on the couch, each person absorbed in a different mobile device. It used to be a joke. Now it's just real. For three decades, MIT professor Sherry Turkle has been studying the ways we interact with machines through her books The Second Self and Life on the Screen. And in her most recent book, Alone Together, she explores the toll digital technology is taking on our personal relationships.
We are living a life mix of what's in the physical and what's in the virtual. And I think that's genuinely new. And that can only come if you have a device with you that lets you, you know, literally be at dinner with your friends, looking up and looking down then a moment at your BlackBerry and doing something in your virtual world, doing something on Facebook, that your life is a mixture of what you do in the real and in the virtual. I was at a funeral. People at the funeral party are hiding their BlackBerries under the funeral program. They're texting. And it didn't just happen once. It happened several times, and many people have spoken to me about similar experiences they've had. It's about not taking a moment at the times that we need to be most present to each other. It's not just about letting our attention wander. It's about forgetting the point of the exercise, which is to be with each other at the times that count. To take a time that's less dark, I was speaking to someone who was talking about a 15-year-old birthday party, and there's a point at this party when everybody wants to go home. And part of being 15 and successfully getting to be 16 is that 15-year-olds have to fight through that moment and learn to get along with each other and to make it work with each other. But at this 15-year-old birthday party, everybody could just, you know, get on their Facebook and be elsewhere and not have to deal with each other. And this option to not just ignore each other, but to really find an active social place in the world that doesn't include each other, I think that is genuinely new. We really need to think about when we need to deliberate, when we need to just be with each other. I think the question is not turning off our technology, not giving it away. This is wonderful technology, but it needs to be put in its place. And sometimes we really just need to be with each other and give each other our full attention. And that's the sense that I fear that we're losing and we need to refocus on.
MIT social scientist Sherry Turkle, she's the author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. Coming up, media theorist Doug Rushkoff will tell us how technology is changing the way we think about time. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Ever feel overwhelmed by digital technology? Like you can never, ever, no matter what you do, keep up with that endless torrent of email and Facebook posts? Well, you're not alone. Media theorist Douglas Rushkoff says this technology has changed our relationship to time, and we're all having trouble adapting to it. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Doug, the title of your book, Present Shock, is a reference to Alvin Toffler's 1970 book, Future Shock. What's the difference between future shock and present shock?
Well, I guess in some sense, maybe the sensation might be similar. The real difference is that the future that Alvin Toffler was describing that we were moving towards is here with us now. So while Toffler was really warning us really to learn how to orient to a world that was changing ever more rapidly, to basically be able to adjust to change itself, I'm arguing that that change has happened, that if anything, you know, as we passed from the 90s into the 21st century, we became less of a society that was just obsessed with the future and what's next and what's happening, what's the next big thing, where is it all going? And we became a society that was very much in the moment, in a kind of an always-on, real-time, hyper-connected moment. So our focus really becomes less about how do we adjust to change to something much more like how do we adjust to living in a world where everything is happening seemingly at the same time.
Hmm. Well, you break this idea of presentism down into five big areas, and let's talk about those. One you call digiphrenia. What is this?
Well, digiphrenia is interesting, and it kind of comes out of that video game sensibility. I mean, the beauty of video games is that instead of watching some other character go through a story, you're the one going through the story. You know, you're the one making the choices in real time, and you move from choice to choice to choice to choice rather than watching these canned choices. It's the sense of agency. But, you know, the digital environment very often makes it seem like you don't even have to choose. You don't have to choose between this and that. You can choose both. And we're doing so many things online where we're choosing both that we've ended up with really multiple instances, multiple incarnations of ourselves, kind of running simultaneously on all these different platforms. And it's very hard to live with more than one you. You know, digital technology is great for copying things, but human beings don't copy so well. So there's you on Twitter that maybe somebody's commenting on something that you did. There's you in your inbox that's filling up with messages that are waiting for responses. There's you on Facebook who might be being used to advertise a product you never even heard of while you're asleep, you know, and you'll wake up that you've been in these sponsored stories. You know, so how do you deal with all of these different yous running simultaneously? That's sort of the essence of this digiphrenia or this kind of digital confusion.
So you're saying that it's enough to make you a little crazy. There's almost like a split personality here because we're tending to so many different digital personae.
Right. And even if your personality is not split, your digital personalities are split and your single personality is going to have to deal with all of them. I got the idea for the digiphrenia chapter when I was in the lobby of a hotel in Berlin. I kept trying to log into my Google Calendar to see if I could do one talk at the same time as another talk, whether I'd be able to get from one to the other in time. And each place I went, I couldn't log in until I finally got Wi-Fi and I'm in this lobby. And I get this message back from Google that they locked me out of my calendar because they said I was trying to log in from too many places at once, right? So Google Calendar didn't believe I was a human being. They didn't believe one human could be in all those places at once. And that, to me, seemed to be the essence of, you know, the problem we have with digital culture. It's not this idea of information overload, and all these people have all these problems with digital technology. And this, I promise you, Present Shock is not one of these books. It's just whining and hand-wringing about the problems of digitality. But what I do get concerned about is our readiness to put our human lives into digital time frames. You know, digital technologies really don't understand time. They live outside time. They're just sequences. You know, your Twitter feed is not in real time. It's just trying to catch up with you. Just because people are sending emails out to you, it doesn't mean that now you have to respond in real time to them, right? The beauty of digital technology was that it waited. You know, the early conversations we used to have on the bulletin boards, we were all so smart because we had all the time in the world to respond to these things.
Now, another aspect of this presentism that we've been talking about is what you call overwinding. What do you mean by overwinding?
Yeah, it's funny. I got the idea for overwinding when I was rereading Stuart Brand's great book, The Clock of the Long Now, in order to write this one. What he argues in there is that we need to think in these great sort of 10,000-year time spans. And I was trying to do that, you know, and I had this plastic water bottle. I was about to get on a plane. I didn't see a recycle bin. There was just a trash can there. And I'm like, do I just throw it out? You know, is it going to be 10,000 years? And I realized it wasn't feeling like a long now to me. It was feeling more like a short forever. And that's where I got the idea of overwinding, where in a presentist society and an always-on sort of micro-moment managed society, it's very tempting to try to compress these really long timescales into really short periods of time. So you'll see examples of that, say, you know, on the stock market, where people don't buy in order to invest in the future of a company, they buy in order to make money on the trade, right? So people buy Facebook in the morning and they're mad 5 minutes later that it hasn't gone up and they go sell it. And people who aren't satisfied with that, you know, they end up buying derivatives on stocks, which are really just a way to buy the future stock now.
Well, it raises questions, fascinating questions about what we mean by real time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a traditional sense of real time of, you know, it was kind of what we would do with our physical body, you know, not dealing with any kind of digital technologies, and yet real time has taken on an entirely different meaning now.
Oh, it has. Real time means this sort of always on Twitter feed. Oh, that's real time. And of course that's not real time. That's 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, 10 seconds ago. It's still not you in real time. The Greeks actually understood this. They had two different words for time. You know, there's the typical one, chronos, which means time of the clock, like it's 4:01. And they had this other word, kairos, which meant timing. And timing was more about your readiness or the appropriateness. Timing was what only humans could really understand. It's like, you know, I crashed the car at 4:01, but what's the best time to tell Dad that I crashed the car? You know, is that 5:01? No, it's timing. You know, that's after he's had his drink and before he's opened the bills, right? It's much more subtle. And that more and more time you spend aware of timing and being ready, the more you begin to connect with all of these cycles that, you know, you could call them new age, but they're actually real. I mean, when you ask me how I work according to the moon.
Wait, so how do you do this? You work according to the lunar cycle?
Yeah, believe it or not. So this is edge science, if you will. So it's the kind of thing that, you know, you do a little experimentation on yourself and just see what works and what doesn't. What I found out was that over a 28-day lunar cycle, there's sort of four main weeks. 28 days is 4 7-day weeks. And in each week, a different neurotransmitter seems to dominate our brain chemistry. The first week is acetylcholine, the second week is serotonin, third week is dopamine, and the last week is norepinephrine. So if you know that, you go, oh my gosh, it's not just me, but everybody's on acetylcholine this week. That means they're going to have good energy, right? They're going to be peppy. It's going to be great for introducing them to new ideas. Serotonin week, everybody's going to have a lot of energy to work. You know, everybody's going to be very productive. So that's when I do my writing. I don't even worry about it the next week. Dopamine week, you're not going to get anything done dopamine week. That's when you're going to go skiing and party and go nuts, right? And the final week, norepinephrine, that's the fight or flight neurotransmitter. So that's putting everybody in a very sort of analytic, structural, sort of Barack Obama mindset. You know, that's where to organize my calendar. That's when to organize the chapters of my book. So when I did that, I stopped thinking of dopamine week, which did turn out to come up every month, as writer's block. That's not what it is. It's something else. This is the time when I'm going to enjoy people and have my parties and do my crazy stuff. You know, and then when I looked at it that way, you know, and I just did it by my efficiency in terms of words, my word count went up about 40%.
Really?
Yeah, when I worked really according to these sort of underlying biological clocks. And this stuff, which we look at as folklore now, you got to remember, we looked at jet lag as folklore and old wives' tales until it was Major League Baseball managers started to realize their pitchers did way better when they traveled from the East Coast to the West than when they traveled from the West Coast to the East. And it didn't make sense until they really came to understand how biological clocks work, our relationship to our melatonin in the sun. And there's all of these other cycles. That's what keeps people alive and in time.
Douglas Rushkoff is a media theorist and the author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. There's no denying the economic impact the tech industry has had on our global economy. Facebook is now worth more than $200 billion. Google's estimated to be worth twice as much. Computer scientist Jaron Lanier explores the rise of the tech giants and the information economy in his book, Who Owns the Future? In it, he explains why he believes it's hurting the middle class.
Here's the issue. The issue is that we've adopted a business model for using information technology where by far the best way to make money is to have the biggest computer on the network in some remote server farm that builds behavioral models of other people and then uses those behavioral models to subtly manipulate those people. And the problem with that business model is that it works so well that it concentrates wealth and power in an incredibly exclusive club of the people who own the biggest computer.
Wow, you're describing 1984.
Well, you know, it's not exactly 1984 because 1984 was all gray and drab. And in truth, most of the people who own the biggest computers are kind of young and hip and cool and nice. And they really are. I mean, we have the sweetest elite in history, probably, but it doesn't matter. The point is that we're concentrating wealth and power so intensely that it's undoing our security and our futures. And I have to point out that the architecture has had its worst effects so far, not in things like social media and search and whatnot, but in finance. But the thing is, if you look at the big hedge funds and high-frequency trading firms and all these concerns, it's the same type of computer, the same algorithms, the same architectures, the same kinds of people, the same kinds of strategy. You know, if you just change the labels, we're looking at the same thing. It's just a way of using information to concentrate power. And so the way it happens is that initially you get some incredibly sweet candy that incites you to enter into the system and give over information to other people. And in finance, it might be a too-good-to-believe mortgage or something like that, or recently maybe bitcoins. But anyway, whatever it is, it's some kind of candy. And then in the case of consumer internet stuff, it's like free services, free social networking or whatever. And then what happens is you start giving over your information to these parties who use it to calculate wealth out of the world. And they are so good at it that they actually undermine the world in which their wealth even makes sense. And that's called too big to fail.
Play this out in more consumer-oriented terms. For instance, you point out this sort of astonishing discrepancy when we used to have big companies like Kodak versus little tiny companies that may be worth more but are, you know, have tiny numbers of employees.
Right. So what's happened now is that we've taken what used to be really huge industries in terms of middle-class jobs like music and photography and this thing you might have heard of called journalism. And
never heard of that.
And what's happened is we've replaced an old system in which there were many hundreds of thousands of solid middle-class jobs with security and the potential for retirement and a safety cushion and all of those good things. And we've replaced them with a system in which there's early treats. There's a really easier on-ramp and this illusion of sort of equity and access for everybody. Well, it's more than an illusion. The early treats can sometimes be very real. But the problem with it is that there's only a token number of success stories, a tiny token number of people who have successful YouTube videos or something like that. And everyone else lives on hope. It's a revival of the old Horatio Alger stories from the 19th century. And this economy of most people sort of scrambling for hope with a tiny number of token winners of sort of princes or the very special unusual people instead of a real middle class is no way to run a civilization. You know, you can't have a democracy that way. A democracy totally relies on people broadly being able to outspend the tip of elites, you know, and we lose that in that world. And it's only starting. I mean, the really big thing happens when the cars are driving themselves and robots are operating the factories or objects are being printed out for us by 3D printers. As the century progresses in a couple decades from now, perhaps, we're going to start to lose a lot of middle class jobs. And the thing about that is that all that stuff still runs on information. Somebody's going to design the objects that are printed out by 3D printers. But if we keep on doing things the way we are, all the money's going to accrue to whatever big computer is routing the information, and only tiny token number of people will actually benefit from the system themselves, and everyone else will live on hope. And that leads us to nowhere. It leads us to a failed economy.
Mm. It sounds like the underlying issue is that we've created a world in which humans seem to be becoming less and less useful. Machines are increasingly better at creating value than people are. And yet, what you're pointing out is that that's an illusion. Of course they're not. We've just created this kind of giant shell game in which we're not valuing the human part of the input.
Exactly. That's precisely what's going on. We're creating a theatrical illusion in which we're pretending that value isn't coming from people in order to support the fantasy of artificial intelligence on a network doing work, which is not real at all. But what it does do is it concentrates huge fortunes with the people who own this illusion.
Right. Well, you've proposed that we, as part of beginning to craft a solution, something you call a humanistic information economy. What is that?
Well, this goes back to the very origin of the whole idea of connecting people on a digital network. What's interesting is that the very first generation of ideas were exactly what I'm proposing. So I'm not really proposing something radically new, but in a way going back to where we started. So back in 1960, the first ideas about how to connect people on digital networks were articulated. And the fellow who did it was named Ted Nelson. He's actually still with us, and he's still named Ted Nelson. And Ted's idea is simple. His parents were Hollywood parents, and he'd seen directly how the labor movement had created a possibility for actors and musicians in Hollywood to find some sense of security, even in a business that was very kind of chancy and where you lived gig to gig. And he realized that someday, as automation got really good and machines got better and better, we'd move into an information economy, and everybody would be living a life that's kind of like what a Hollywood actor or musician was living, and everybody would need the same kinds of benefits. Everybody who's a truck driver now, or a miner, or a teacher, or a doctor, or a nurse, or anybody at all was going to be in the same boat. And he saw that there was a kind of simple solution, actually. And the solution is to always keep track of where information comes from on a network. And if you have a link back to whoever was the source of information that's useful later, you can send them a micropayment. And if you have a universal micropayment system in a richly, densely connected network, you would naturally create a middle class out of an information economy that would be persistent. And then you could afford to have a democracy because the middle class could always outspend the elite and so forth. So it would create a solution that would finally get us beyond the fear of automation killing jobs.
Well, wait, does this mean that to open a link a friend puts on Facebook, I'd have to pay her?
Well, right. And the key thing to remember is that you're also getting paid. I mean, the whole thing about capitalism is that you have to kind of go on faith that even though you have to pay for stuff, you're also getting paid for your stuff. And by having economic activity, the overall value of the society is going up. So on average, people are doing better than they otherwise would.
So the goal would be to post more stuff than you read.
No, not exactly. Here's the way I see it working out. The way the world is currently working now is all of us are being scrutinized constantly by algorithms and remote big computers. They're behavioral models of all of us, and third parties are paying to use those models to manipulate us. They manipulate what links you see on Google and who you're introduced to on Facebook and all kinds of stuff like that. And the idea is to sort of gradually create this perfect investment where you can just pay to manipulate the world to your benefit. Now, the thing is that all of that value that we're providing is very real. So if we just kept track of whenever there are bits that exist because of you, even if you didn't intend to create them, and that would create a micropayment, you'd constantly be earning little dribs and drabs of money. It's not necessarily a conscious thing.
Whoa, do you mean that if I'm like browsing the new books at Amazon, and of course Amazon keeps track of what books I look at, later I'm going to get a little check in the mail from Amazon?
If and only if that data contributes to Amazon being able to increase its profits by using that data in some way. Yeah, absolutely. And I know this might sound like sort of an alien or weird scheme to people, but the thing you have to understand is that the complexity of it is actually less than what we're doing now. People don't understand how insane what we're doing now is. And the notion that keeping track of where value comes from will actually lead to betterment for people is just the same old weird trick of capitalism, which does actually work. So it's just a combination of using network design and capitalism together more efficiently than what we're currently doing. And I know it sounds sort of alien and weird, but it actually does make sense.
Computer scientist Jaron Lanier is the author of Who Owns the Future? Switching gears, when we come back, Doug Peacock has a dangerous idea, and journalist Naomi Klein critiques market-based solutions to climate change. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name's Doug Peacock. I'm a wilderness advocate, defender of wilderness. I've written books like Grizzly Years, Walking It Off, In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, and a couple others. And my dangerous idea is forget about Habitat for Humanity. Just blow it off. Wipe it off your consciousness. What I'm advocating is we owe the Earth a fight to save habitat for all creatures, not just humans. These are the most dangerous times in the history of our species. Only once, 73,000 years ago, when a great volcano blew off, did Homo sapiens stand in danger of going extinct. They went through a bottleneck. Some people think down to the low thousands worldwide in Africa. Today, the beast of our time is variously called climate change or global warming. It certainly is upon us, and I believe it's probably already irreversible. And these are the most dangerous times in our history. We're going to go through a bottleneck of our own, I believe. And when we do it, we're going to take down virtually all the large animals, lots of plants. We don't know. It is the sixth great extinction, and we have caused it. We need to save the original habitat for human beings. Homo sapiens didn't evolve in cities or farms. We evolved in the jungles, on the tundra, in the Arctic, on the Great Plains, in the woodlands. We humans have known about global warming and where it's going for a long time. We haven't done a damn significant thing to stop it. It's like we humans have a collective Asperger's syndrome. We're brilliant, and we know how to make money. We know how to build pipelines and mine coal and burn fossil fuels. But like with Asperger's, we don't have the empathy to really care about the grandchildren of the world, including our own. We can't look down it and do anything corrective about our consumptive lives to protect the innocent of the world. With great droughts in Asia and Africa driving the Chinese into Siberia, where they're probably going to nuke it out, and all the fallout from that, we could lose 3/4 of the world's population. That is possible. I won't say how many decades, but it's going to be sooner than later. End of the decade is a better phrase than end of the century. We know from studies of combat units that once a combat unit loses 3/4 of its people to casualties, there's a paralytic psychosis that comes over people. Some thinkers think that human civilization itself is going to go. You know, the surviving world in 100 years, if there's any humans around at all, are going to be ruled by brutal warlords and thug-like communities. Technology will not bail us out of this one. It's not going to bail us out. We're going to pay the price. And saving wilderness, above all, it's the right thing to do. And it's also our own best chance.
That's Doug Peacock with his dangerous idea. And you can hear more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. Climate change is on our minds this week, now that the U.S. and China have announced plans to curb carbon emissions by 2030. Journalist Naomi Klein has been thinking about our current approaches to global warming, and she thinks we're getting it wrong. Her new book is called This Changes Everything: Capitalism Versus the Climate. She stopped by our studios recently and told Steve Paulson that tackling climate change is more urgent than ever.
For a long time, climate change was like this grandchildren problem. But that's really changing, you know? I mean, we are experiencing the impacts of climate change in the here and now. It's gone from being this grandchildren problem to being a banging down our door problem pretty rapidly. And that is changing the discussion because of people's lived experience with extreme weather. And yet we're still denying. And I think we're denying in the sense of, looking away, right? So we're living with this cognitive dissonance of, on the one hand, being told and indeed experiencing the reality of climate change in these moments, and on the other hand, living in a culture that is sending us the opposite message through the policies that are all around us and the culture that's all around us. So we look away.
So how much urgency is there here? I mean, let's talk about possible scenarios. If the global temperature goes up 2 degrees Celsius, which is what, 3.7 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that, or 4 degrees Celsius, which is within the forecasts. What will happen?
So where we're at is we are currently on the road towards 4 to 6 degrees warming, 4 to 6 degrees Celsius. So on the high end, around 10.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. That's a lot of warming. And these projections come from very conservative institutions. This is not, you know, me and my lefty friends. This is the World Bank. This is the International Energy Agency. This is PricewaterhouseCoopers says we're on a trajectory towards 6 degrees Celsius warming. So the reason that we should be alarmed is that when our governments, including the U.S. government, went to Copenhagen in 2009, which was the last big climate summit, our governments agreed to keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius because they said anything above 2 degrees Celsius is catastrophic. And that target itself was extremely controversial. African delegates were protesting in the halls saying that this would be catastrophic for them because in sub-Saharan Africa, it would translate into warming that would be absolutely devastating because we've already increased temperatures by around 0.7 and we are already seeing the impacts. So we're talking about more than doubling that. But after you go past 2 degrees warming, the climate models start to break down, really. 4 degrees, we're talking about countries disappearing. We're talking about major cities.
Because of the rising sea levels?
Because of rising sea levels. We're talking about crop level failures of around 60%. And that's at 4 degrees. No one even bothers to try to guess what 6 degrees would look like because, things start to go nonlinear. And so if those sorts of projections are without triggering tipping points, right, without setting off just really nonlinear reactions. And everybody agrees we do not want to be warming temperatures by 4 degrees Celsius or 6 degrees Celsius.
And our governments have agreed to it. What are the timelines right here? I mean, in terms of some of these mainstream institutions you've mentioned, the World Bank, I mean, you know, given current trends, if things don't change, you know, at what point do we hit 4 degrees warming?
Well, this is really imprecise. I mean, we don't know, but it could be as early as mid-century. It could be by end of century. The exact moment when we would hit certain temperatures, the science there is not clear enough. But what we do know is that there's a delayed response and we have a global carbon budget. And we have already used up a whole lot of it. So we need to start scaling back because we can't just sort of slam on the brakes all at once. So this is why we need a sort of system of gradual emission reductions. And what, for instance, the Tyndall Center in Manchester, England, which is one of the leading climate change research institutions, says is that we need to be cutting our emissions by 8 to 10% a year starting now so that we aren't slamming on the brakes so quickly that we would be dealing with a massive economic crash.
8 to 10% each year. Okay. How can we do that? I mean, that sounds, you know, pretty unrealistic.
Well, first of all, those numbers are based on that global carbon budget that was produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But the Tyndall Center researchers are also saying, okay, our governments also agreed that our approach to climate change has to be based on some sense of historical equity in the sense that the countries that have been emitting carbon for 200 years by burning fossil fuels need to start reducing more quickly than so-called emerging markets. India and China also need to be cutting their emissions, you know, within the next decade, but they have a little bit more time to play with. So that's why we need to cut deeper, faster.
So who's responsible here? Are these decisions that have to be made at the governmental level? I mean, individual countries saying, okay, we're going to rein in emissions.
Well, the United Nations has traditionally been the main forum in which we have developed emission reduction plans, and then countries within that framework develop their own plans for how they're going to meet their targets. So, which is to say, we need to do it all. We need to work together because this is a truly global crisis that does not respect national boundaries. It doesn't make sense for us to only do this as individual countries. We have to come up with a plan that says, okay, we're all doing this now because people feel helpless.
Now, one of the points that you make in your book, This Changes Everything, is that this is a historic opportunity, you know, to really shift the way the economy works. And I mean, really what you're talking about is trying to move to, I guess, what we would call a post-carbon economy. How could this be done?
So the book is making a pretty radical argument that we aren't going to do this within the confines of our current political reality. It will require a profound change, including a profound ideological shift. We've moved very far in one direction, a direction which has really vilified collective action, that has vilified intervening in the market, vilified taxation, vilified public investments. So if you're asking how we do this, we have to do all those things. I mean, we have to make the polluters pay. The money is there.
What does that mean, to make polluters pay?
Well, it would mean a variety of things. It would mean higher royalty rates on extraction of fossil fuels. It could mean higher taxes on exports of fossil fuels. It could mean luxury taxes because the wealthiest among us are also the highest emitters. It could also mean a financial transaction tax. I mean, there's all kinds of ways of getting at that money, but all of them break the cardinal rules of, no, we're not supposed to tax. And even now in this country, when we talk about, okay, well, what policies should the environmental movement champion now? We tried cap and trade. That didn't work. Now there's a fair bit of momentum behind the idea of cap and dividend, which is the idea of putting a tax on carbon, but then returning all the money in the form of individual checks to American consumers. So the problem with that is that it's designed to be bipartisan in that it's designed to appease this idea that there is something sinister and wrong with taxation. Mm-hmm. And it deprives the public sector of the resources needed to make this energy transition, because there have to be massive investments in public transit, massive investments in changing the energy grid, in reducing demand for fossil fuels, in redesigning our agricultural system. All of this requires public investment.
So walk me through some of these things. So you've just mentioned public transportation. So yeah. Basically sort of, you know, trying to get fewer people to drive cars and instead take public transit. What else
well,
needs
to happen? Well, light rail as well is important because a lot of people take unnecessary short haul flights because the rail system mm-hmm. has just eroded and eroded. So it's sort of reimagining transportation, redesigning our cities. It's not just about public transit. It's also about redesigning our cities in a way that commutes, long commutes, aren't less necessary, so that we live in neighborhoods where the services we need, the groceries we need are walking distance, biking distance. And so that's how you reduce the demand, because it isn't just about sort of flipping a switch from one form of energy to another form of energy. It's also about consuming less energy. So some of that can be done with efficiency, but a lot of that has to do with just reimagining and rethinking mobility, how we get around. And the truth is, this makes us happier. I mean, people hate their commutes. So a lot of what we need to do to address climate change is going to improve our quality of life, is going to strengthen our communities. But it will mean consuming less. But one of the arguments I'm making in the book is that the ascendancy of this ideological project of market fundamentalism has eroded our communities in lots of fronts and eroded our public institutions. So we feel the need to shop more because we're filling a void in our lives. You know, there's been an explosion in the idea of consumption as hobby, as identity, as pastime, as holiday, that is part of this same project. So as we shift, as we strengthen the public sphere, as we strengthen communities, we don't need to fill those voids with shopping. We can shop for what we need instead of shopping as a way of life.
So you're taking on consumer capitalism here.
Yeah, I am.
Good luck. I mean, well, are you really?
I mean, this is why I'm honest that this is not just about landing on the right sort of technology and the right sort of, is it cap and dividend? Is it cap and trade?
Or is it geoengineering the climate, figuring out with some fancy new technologies to suck out some of the CO2 emissions?
Well, I mean, I have a chapter on geoengineering in the book, and I think it's precisely because because it is so hard for us to imagine the kind of political shift that's necessary to deal with this crisis, that we're in this strange state where it is easier to imagine dimming the sun than putting solar panels on people's roofs on a massive scale. It's really scary. I mean, looking at these technologies, the risks are enormous. The sort of most credible geoengineering idea is sometimes called the Pinatubo option, the idea of spraying sulfur into the stratosphere in order to mimic a volcano and sort of forcibly reduce temperatures by limiting the amount of sunlight that reaches Earth. You know, volcanoes have a really scary history of volcanoes of that kind because they're linked to droughts. There's lots of historical evidence that they interfere with the monsoons in Asia and Africa. A lot of the modeling is showing the same thing. So we're talking about huge gambles precisely because it is easier to imagine that than changing capitalism. And the argument I'm making is we can't change the laws of nature, but we can change the laws of our economic system.
So given all that you've said, I mean, the disaster scenario ahead of us, it would seem like it's a pretty depressing time. I mean, are you an optimist or more a pessimist?
No, I wouldn't describe myself as an optimist. I see the possibility of transformation. I have witnessed in my life moments when social movements grab the wheel of history and swerve. So long as we can imagine a non-catastrophic outcome here, so long as we can imagine that there is a possibility, I think we have a moral responsibility to fight for it. I don't see it as an odds game, like what are our percentages? You know, if we looked at it that way, I think we'd all be depressed. I'm not saying, you know, it's a foregone conclusion. I'm not even saying our chances are good. All I'm saying is there is still the possibility of acting with enough decisiveness to avoid those catastrophic outcomes that our scientists are warning us about. But it will take tremendous effort.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Journalist Naomi Klein talked with Steve about her latest book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tongakar produced today's show with help from Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.